supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Dean Alasco is up for the Marlins and the Union take on Real Salt Lake tonight. Action beginning at 9. Temperature in Center City, 75 degrees. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little bit later in the show, a very controversial topic. How often should you turn your compost piles? Do you have to turn your compost piles at all? What happens if you don't? And what about those compost tumblers and spinners? Can you get away without turning them? How often do you have to if you can't? We will answer all those burning questions when we get to the question of the week, but mostly it's a fabulous phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to take that heaping helping at 1-888-346-9499. Laurie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for making it, Laurie. Where are you?
I am in beautiful Ringo's, New Jersey.
Ringo's, New Jersey. I always thought that was the funniest name for a town.
It sure is, but I tell you, it's a real sweet place to live. It's absolutely gorgeous.
I know, but it should be next to John and Paul and George, New Jersey, or something, you know.
What's happened is that I've been doing a fabulous organic vegetable garden for years and years and years, about 10 years here in Ringo's. About 3 weeks ago, I started to get my first crop of absolutely gorgeous zucchinis and yellow squashes. Everything was just humming along fabulously. And then Saturday, like maybe a half hour before I heard your show, I suddenly was in my garden and I noticed that the leaves on these squashes and zucchini plants were suddenly like poof, powdery, white looking. Mm-hmm. I didn't see bugs on them or anything, but I figured that was not a good sign. And between Saturday and today, I actually have had to commit like zucchini side and pull up about half of the plants because they just died. They just turned brown, gotten mushy, and disappeared. And I wonder if there's anything I can do to rescue what's left.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know what happened, of course, is that we were having this incredible hot and dry spell. And for the first time in ages, people were having to water their plants and, you know, try to keep things cool. And then, of course, you know, you never get what you want, which is a good soaking rain and then a dry spell, then a good soaking rain and then a dry spell. Because after that, we had really relentless heavy rains that dropped in most places 6 or 8 inches of water in like a day. Then you have way too much water, followed by humidity. Disease is a very common problem. But I'm just guessing that maybe your garden was a little crowded to begin with.
Well, I don't know. You know, raised bed, and I had just sort of juiced it up again this year and put an extra, I don't know, 5 inches or so of soil in there. So it was looking pretty good.
Now, what kind of soil?
A mix of I don't remember what it was, but it seemed good. And I also added, I have a fish pond, and I took the, you know, the fish poop and put that in, and I think everybody liked that as well.
In the future, when you freshen up your raised beds, try to get good high-quality yard waste compost and use that in your raised bed. That's a natural disease preventative. When people say they've added soil, they could often be doing no good and might be doing negative. Now, the reason I said that I thought your garden might be crowded is you said you had pulled out about half the plants. And gardens are never crowded when we put these little baby plants in the ground. But it is very difficult to actually think about the final size of the plant and plant for that final size so there's air space in between your plants. And I can tell you right now, with big honking leaves like zucchini, when those leaves overlap and they start getting against each other in a wet environment, they can hold a lot of moisture. And it sounds like you had an attack of powdery mildew. So taking out the dead plants must have improved the airflow in your garden. Now there's a lot more room between the plants, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Do you still have any diseased leaves out there?
I haven't had a chance to look today, but I think I pulled out everything that looked like it was diseased yesterday afternoon.
Good. What I want you to do is keep an eye out for diseased leaves and just clip those off the plant and throw them away, trash them. Don't compost them or anything like that. If you can find a nice supply of compost, just like an inch, even a half an inch on the surface of the soil. Now, obviously, you haven't had to water your plants since the heavy rains arrived. But when you water your plants, do you water them overhead?
No. We have soaker hoses throughout the garden.
Okay. If it is powdery mildew as opposed to downy mildew, and it shows up again, if there's an isolated plant, what I would like you to do as a test is to actually try to wash the disease off with sharp sprays of water first thing in the morning on one test plant alone, and don't pull those leaves off. If the symptoms get better, then that's what I want you to do. If the symptoms don't get better, I want you to try a crazy idea. I want you to make a 10% milk solution. Mix up one part milk to nine parts water and spray it on the leaves first thing in the morning. There is some fabulous whacked-out research that shows that this 10% milk spray is highly effective against several types of mildew, much more effective than any packaged fungicide.
Huh. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right. Well, good luck with your mildew.
All righty.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. 1-888-346-9499. Greg, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, Greg from Lothian. I have two large Japanese maple trees, about 20 to 25 foot tall,
mm-hmm.
16 foot maybe diameter.
Right.
And when you look inside the tree, you see a lot of small branches in the inner tree structure where they're just stripped clean.
Hmm.
Now, I don't see any Japanese beetles, which I have in the past, years before, but I don't see any Japanese beetles or any small aphids or anything.
Right.
But I did see a praying mantis stalking around, so that usually means something's there.
Well, now, Greg, where did you say you were located, sir?
In South County, Lothian, Maryland.
Oh, Maryland. Okay. Yeah, you know, I hate to say anything here to lean into this, but my perceptions about those cursed Japanese beetles are the same. I haven't seen any in, like, the last 2 years. So I know they keep releasing all these different diseases and viruses and funguses that attack the beetles naturally, and maybe they're finally getting under control, or maybe they're just marshaling their forces across the river and getting ready
no,
to
they're
wipe
all
out.
Over my hibiscus plants.
Really?
And I've been trapping them as well, but they're just all over the place right now, except for all my Japanese maples, which they're usually there.
Gotcha. Well, I want you to get those traps off your property.
Okay.
Because you're attracting many more beetles to your property than the traps can catch. You have fewer beetles with no traps than you do with traps.
Okay. Yeah, you can really smell them things. They got a big
aroma.
Oh,
man, when they've been sitting in the sun for a couple of days, I mean, it's very satisfying to look at the bag full of beetles. But
right.
But only 20% of those beetles would have come to your property without that lure.
Wow.
So no trap can catch more than 50% of the insects in the environment. So you effectively double your beetle population by spending money on those traps.
Okay. I will dispose of them tonight.
I have seen this on various trees, and it's funny you bring up this kind of missing branch and stripped branches. What I have seen doing this, and I actually got hit on the head by a dropped branch full of leaves the other day, and looked up, and the little psychotic creature was laughing at me insanely. It's squirrels.
Okay.
Squirrels strip these branches. Sometimes they gnaw off entire branches. Sometimes they strip them. And then they go and make these elaborate nests up in the trees, and they line them with the branches and the leaves so they can support their little plasma televisions and their little refrigerators and plot our destruction, the destruction of all good and decent creatures on the planet.
Well, I think you hit it on the head, because I have probably four or five different bird feeders, and I also have a squirrel feeder that the squirrels come and eat. But I, at any given time, there's about 12 to 18 squirrels on my property.
You're in for a world of trouble, Greg, because after they're done stripping your trees, it's not going to take them long to decide that they don't like the trees as much as they like the top of your house. And they will try to gnaw their way in. I think it's a big mistake to feed squirrels.
Okay.
You know, they can find all their own food in the wild, and you really don't want them to get comfortable on your property. They have a, for instance, at my house, they have a nasty habit of pulling out all my spring bulbs and replanting black walnut trees in their place. They're evil creatures. So stop feeding them. And I wouldn't feed the birds any kind of seed in the summertime. You know what birds need in the summertime from you is lots of bird baths. Because water can get very scarce. But they don't need your seed. They can find food in the wild. So just stop filling those things. You know, maybe the squirrels will get comfortable somewhere else. But if you don't feed birds and squirrels in the summertime, the problem should go away.
Okay, great, great. I think you're going to solve my problem for me.
Always a pleasure, Greg. Thank you very much, man.
Okay, Mike McGrath, you have a good weekend.
You too, sir.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and suggest that listeners with an abundance of garden goodies donate some of that extra produce to their local food bank to help feed the hungry in their area. Many food banks are equipped to accept such donations, and it's always a mitzvah to help those in need. But don't you go browsing to the Feeding America website to locate the food bank nearest you just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and the truth about turning your compost. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Well-Composted Garden.
This is WHYY.
Morris Arboretum proudly supports WHYY and offers a natural way to escape the heat at its 92-acre garden in Chestnut Hill. Visitors can experience the cooling power of trees in a whole new way with Out on a Limb, a canopy walk 50 feet up in the treetops. Their garden railway display, Painted Ladies, is open now through Labor Day, with model trains, bridges, and tunnels on an outdoor quarter-mile track surrounded by colorful Victorian houses. Details at morrisarboretum.org.
What does 9/11 mean to you? Where were you on that day 10 years ago? And what has changed in your life since then? Explore personal stories collected by WHYY and feel free to share your own. Visit whyy.org/after9/11.
The WHYY Connections Festival rocks the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing today with headliner Dr. Dog. Gates open at 2 for a free day of live music. More at whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's what I like to call the dirty little secret of organic gardening. How often do other people really turn their compost pile? Do they make you feel guilty because you don't think you turn yours often enough? We'll discuss the realities, the real-life situation of compost turning when we get to the question of the week. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Tom. How are you doing?
Oh, not too bad. It's more than I can say for the arborvitae I'm dealing with, though.
Okay, so where are you, Tom?
In Yardley.
Yardley, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
Just outside of Philly.
Not too far from you.
Okay, arborvitae, let me guess. Deer are eating it, caterpillars are eating it, or it's turning brown?
Bagworms are eating it, and it's turning brown.
Okay, well, that's the same thing. Bagworms, I hate the fact that somebody started using worms as a synonym for caterpillar pests, because they are not worms of any kind, but... bagworms are one of the most tenacious of the caterpillar pest. Now, did you know you had bagworms right away, or did you think these were little pine cones?
Now, about a week ago, I noticed that without benefit of the wind, parts of the tree were moving.
Oh, man. So that meant the bagworms were out and feeding?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you think they're still feeding?
Well, we called the county ag agent, and they suggested putting BTK on them.
Right, yes.
I couldn't find any of that, so I did try a couple sprayings of BT.
Oh, no. Now, see, that's you might have used the right stuff. The oldest form of BT is called BTK. It's the Korstocki strain. Mm-hmm. And this has been around for like 70 years, and any caterpillars that eat the sprayed leaves will die.
Right, how about just plain BT as in Thuricide?
Exactly. That is BTK.
Oh, it is?
Okay. Yes.
It doesn't say so on the label, though.
Actually, it should. If you look down in the very fine print where it says active ingredient, in probably three-point type, it'll say Bacillus, mm-hmm. Thuringiensis, Korstocki strain.
Okay. Well, that seems to have had some effect, though. It did not at first, obviously. It took a few days.
Right. That's exactly right. But you found the perfect control. If the caterpillars are feeding, it takes them about a day to ingest the BT. Then their stomachs quickly stop working correctly. So even though they're not dead yet, they're no longer feeding. And then within a few days, they're all dead, and there's no harm to anything else in the environment. Even your local birds and toads can eat the dead caterpillars and not be harmed. What you want to do now...
That's what I want to ask, is what to do next. Because for better or worse, we also, about the top third of the tree was absolutely filled with these critters. They didn't seem to be dying right away, and it was pretty brown, so we took it off.
Well, I would not have advised that.
Right. I gather that might not have been the best move, but in light of having done that, what would you advise? How do we, nurse the tree to get it through... Into next year and so on.
Well, the topping that you did is probably fatal. The tree...
It has been topped once before by a landscaper that used to work the area.
But he didn't cut it off cleanly. He shaped it to a new point. Or did he just cut the top off?
I think it was just the topping, if I remember correctly.
Okay,
well, years ago.
Then he should lose his license.
It wasn't his idea, actually. It was the association that was sort of pushing the idea. If I recall correctly, he was not particularly thrilled with it. But
no, he should.
Unless the tree survived.
He should have. Yeah, but it looks ugly as heck. You know, the beauty of arborvitae and Leyland cypress is the point they come up to. Mm-hmm. So a top tree looks really ugly.
It's flat on the top.
Yeah, and it can't grow anymore. You know, that's the growing tip. That's like cutting one of our heads off. I mean, you know, theoretically, like a chicken, if they do it quick enough, we may stagger around for a while, but we don't look too hot, and our future is immensely poor.
To maximize the odds, what would you suggest?
You want to walk around the tree, you want to go up on a ladder, you want to look for those little fake pine cones that the creatures nest inside of. And even if all your bagworms are dead, you want to gently prune off those pine cones.
Believe it or not, I pulled off close to 700 already.
I believe you. And that is the best thing you can do for the tree. Spray the tree with BT to stop the caterpillar infestation, and then get as many of their nests off as you can, and then give the trees a nice little feeding with some compost, no tree spikes or chemical fertilizers, and they can often recover from the damage.
Mm-hmm.
All right, man?
Okay, I'll hope for the best.
All right, good luck, Tom.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Scott, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey there, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you today, sir?
I am kicking like a chicken.
Okay, and where are you doing that suspicious thing?
I am in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. Very good to hear from our Oklahoma friends. Always a pleasure. What can we do for you, Scott?
Hey, I have a couple of questions. I own a landscape company, so I'm running into tips and tricks and myths and facts. So I'm looking for an answer for two things that are pretty widely spread as far as flies and mosquitoes.
Okay, shoot.
So first, the flies, the thing that I've heard of and read on the web and know a lot of people who do it is put a penny in a Ziploc bag on your door seal or above your window, and it'll keep the flies out.
Really? And is that because the penny's upside down and the flies know that that's bad luck?
You know, I have no idea. What I've read on the web is that when you put a penny in the water, because flies have multiple eyes or they can see multiple things, the penny in the water molecules kind of scares them off.
What, because they think there's more money there? Makes no sense, Scott. Bogus.
All right, well, that's good to know. So my other question is regarding mosquitoes and trying to find a deterrent other than, of course, pesticides or chemicals. What I've read and have tried in the past is a combination of citronella oil, geranium oil, lemongrass oil, and peppermint oil.
I think that you just got 3 out of 4. So that's a good start. Now, when you say these oils, are you spraying them around? Are you wearing them on your person? Are you adorning your underarms with the scent of these things? What's going on here?
Well, what I've made in the past is a small spray bottle to spray on your person, a mixture of 3 or 4 of the oils that I mentioned, and it seems to me it works great.
I'm
trying to use anything I can other than the DEET chemical, because I have heard, and you could probably answer this question as well, I've heard that DEET is a renamed D in the DDT from the old days.
I would be very careful about regular humans mixing essential oils. You have to be really careful. Essential oils, the true distillate power of these powerful herbs, can be very harsh on human skin. It can cut right through it. So you have to make sure that if you're using an essential oil, it's very heavily diluted in some carrier oil, like the almond oil that a massage therapist would use.
Uh-huh.
And when this is done, there is some theory that it is the oil on your skin that makes it unpleasant for mosquitoes to land on you. I will say that there are natural mosquito repellents, packaged ones, and these all tend to be based on some lemon-scented herb. The oldest one that's around, Bite Blocker, I believe you even mentioned geranium. It contains the essence of a lemon-scented geranium plant. Lemon is very repellent to mosquitoes, and that's in an oil. It might be canola oil. I forget what kind of edible oil it's in, but the oil provides a little bit of a barrier, and then the lemon scent really does, whether it drives them away or it masks your odor of carbon dioxide, Bite Blocker and a similar product that's called Repel Lemon Eucalyptus, and this is a eucalyptus plant that has a lemon-scented version. Both of these have been shown to work just as well as some concentrations of DEET in published medical studies. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine. The studies were originally run by a North Carolina dermatologist, and he did some fascinating work, and they actually used, if you're as old as I am, do you remember the old cage in do you remember the old arm in the cage commercial for Off?
Where some,
yeah, they actually use that. That's how they test these things. So you don't want to be a starving medical student down in Florida. That's that's where the guy is with the cage. And, hey, you know, but your arm is worth $50 a pop. You know, that's a lot of beer money when you're a struggling medical student.
Sure.
So those two packaged products have been shown to work. I will tell you that I grow a lot of lemon balm in my garden simply so that I can harvest it, crush up the leaves, and rub them on my skin. Lemon thyme, which is a beautiful kind of tiny trailing plant that looks fabulous in rock gardens and big containers, T-H-Y-M-E, but it's lemon-scented thyme, very beautiful plant. That is the most effective herbal natural plant repellent, but it's hard to grow large amounts if you have any experience, whereby lemon balm, you can't help but grow huge amounts. Also,
so lemon thyme.
Lemon thyme is the winner in controlled studies of various plants that were crushed up and rubbed on the skin. Lemon thyme just went through the roof. That rang the bell. And the problem with DEET, D-E-E-T, which I don't believe is a form of DDT, but DEET is absorbed into the body and leaves via your liver and kidneys. And mine get enough of a workout already, so I don't need anything else clogging up those expressways.
Excellent. That sounds great. Make plenty of notes.
All right. Good luck, Scott. Stay unbitten this summer.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. Angie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's great to talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you, Angie. Where are you?
I'm in Parkside, Pennsylvania. I'm just south of Philadelphia, about 25 miles.
I've never heard of Parkside.
Really?
Yeah. But I believe you, Angie. You've never lied to me before. I don't think you're going to start now. What can we do for you?
Well, I've been listening to your show for years and years and years, and I've never grown anything. My friends and family, everyone laughs at me that I'm such a religious listener to the show and had never grown anything. But it's mostly because I was in tiny apartments and just no place to grow. And this past May, I moved here, and we have a five-bedroom house, and one of the first things I did was put in a garden bed, a really, really big one. And I thought I was being a good student and doing everything that I had learned from, you know, my years of listening. The only thing I know I did wrong was I didn't start small. My bed is 20 feet long. But other than that, I didn't think I was making any mistakes. But I don't seem to be getting any fruit. The cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers, I have one of each on each of the plants, and that's about it. And
okay.
I'm just wondering, what am I doing wrong?
Now, when you say you put in a garden bed, is it a raised bed or flat ground?
It's a raised bed.
And how wide is it?
4 feet wide.
Oh, 20 feet long and 4 foot wide is fine. What did you fill it with?
I filled it with compost. We actually have a compost farm here in our county, and they provide compost to the residents for free. So we just made several trips and filled it up.
And it was yard waste compost?
Yard waste compost, right.
Okay, very good. And have you fed the plants anything else?
Just recently, because I was so concerned that the plants were growing beautifully but no fruit, so I put some fertilizer on the on the sides of the stalks. But other than that, I didn't do anything else.
Chemical fertilizer or organic?
It's a purely organic fertilizer that I got from our local nursery.
And granular?
Yes.
Okay, you have to cover that stuff with some more compost.
Oh, okay.
Because whenever you use granular fertilizer, you're supposed to spread it around the plants and then cover the fertilizer with some compost to help it become active.
So
you may see the results of that coming up soon. This is, as you know, this has been a glorious season for plant growth, and the plants are using up a lot of nutrients. So I think supplying an organic fertilizer, even before you talk to me, could put you ahead by a week or so here. But just next time you go out, work it into the soil or cover it with more soil or compost. Just don't let it sit exposed to the sun, because it won't do any good. And how do you water your plants during the dry heat waves we had?
Well, I've been trying to resist the urge to overwater. I know that's a rookie mistake. So I've been watering for really deep watering once a week, maybe twice a week if it's, you know, been really hot.
Are they getting full sun all day long?
They get sun until about 3 in the afternoon, I would say.
From first thing in the morning?
From first thing in the morning, yeah.
Boy, I tell you, Ange, this is, you know, you're not doing anything really wrong that I can figure. And your plants are big and lush, right?
They look great. They're really tall. They've got lots of leaves. I'm just getting very few flowers, and the flowers that I'm getting are producing, you know, I have 9 tomato plants and 1 tomato, and, you know, 4 cucumber plants and 1 cucumber.
And you haven't used any manure in the soil or any, you're not giving it coffee grounds. There's no other source of high nitrogen here?
Oh, I did put coffee grounds in.
Oh,
I did it.
Why?
I read it somewhere that I was supposed to add coffee grounds to the compost because it was nitrogen poor.
Oh, no, 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 no. Okay, good, good, because you were really confusing me, but I'm happy here. You've over nitrogen fed your plants. That's a that is a rookie mistake. Horse manure, poultry manure, coffee grounds, all of these things are very rich in nitrogen, and as you've seen, it grows huge plants, but it inhibits fruit production. So no more coffee grounds. What I want you to do is go to a garden center, get a nice big bag of bone meal, and then spread that throughout your garden. And do what I said with the with the granular fertilizer. Spread the bone meal around the base of your plants, about a cup of bone meal per plant, and then cover that with some soil or compost. Water it in. No more coffee grounds. I think by the time the season is over this year, you'll have more produce than you know what to do with.
Fantastic. Awesome. Great.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Absolute pleasure, Angie. You take care and you enjoy your garden.
Will do. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and alert our listeners in the north and other cooler-than-average areas that the second season is arriving. Yes, it's time to start readying a bed for the sowing of cool-season crops like lettuce, spinach, and other greens, beets, and late-run radishes, too. And it's time to start scanning garden centers and nurseries for starts of broccoli and pansies and Brussels sprouts. Oh, my! But don't you go saying, what? The summer's almost over, but I still didn't get my tomatoes in the ground just yet. Because we'll be right back with talking about your compost pile and turning it and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Well-Termed Garden.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. I'll host a fundraiser for the folks who green up the historic Fairhill Burial Ground on Sunday, September 18th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the University Barge Club on beautiful Boathouse Row. Then on Saturday, September 24th, I'll get you ready for the second season of gardening with a talk on garlic, pansies, fall greens, and more at 1:30 at the Lower Gwynedd Country Picnic in Penlyn Woods at Penlyn Pike and Township Line Road. The Great Chili Pepper Festival returns to Bowers, PA this Friday and Saturday, September 9th and 10th. And the Scott Arboretum's 2011 plant sale will be held September 16th to the 18th. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
Later today on Fresh Air Weekend, journalist Mark Levinson tells the story of the A&P, once the largest retailer in the world, and how, for better or worse, the company revolutionized how food is sold and bought. Also, Alice Waters, one of the mothers of the locally grown sustainable food movement. She's celebrating the 40th anniversary of her Berkeley restaurant, Chez Panisse. Fresh Air Weekend at 1 today right here on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. Yes, in just a few short minutes, as opposed to those agonizing long minutes, we'll be talking about compost and the turning of the compost. How often do people really turn their compost piles and tumblers? Let's be honest here, kids. And we will, right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Vince, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Good afternoon, Michael. I appreciate your show. Love listening to you.
Well, thank you, sir. Where are you?
Salt Lake City.
Oh, okay. Very good. Down in Utah. What can we do for you, sir?
I have a couple of questions for you. I overheard you speak of how to get rid of reoccurring weeds. My wife spends a lot of time on her hands and knees pulling weeds, and they just keep coming back.
Right.
Second question is morning glory.
Uh-oh.
Don't do that.
Now, Vince, when you say morning glory, obviously we're talking about a vining plant, very thin wine, very distinctive flowers. What color are your flowers?
White.
Okay. You don't have morning glory.
What is that?
It's called bindweed, B-I-N-D-W-E-E-D. Bindweed is one of the most tenacious plants. Morning glory, with the beautiful light blue kind of purplish flowers, that's an annual plant. So if you live in an area with killing frost, your morning glory dies from year to year. You may have it come back from drop seed, but there is no underground plant part that's alive all the time. Bindweed is murderous. Bindweed is very difficult to eradicate.
Gotcha.
Now, where's the bindweed?
It's in my grass, and I just put sod down, and the sod is healthy, it's green, it's vibrant, and all of a sudden I'm getting 100 of them.
Okay, so what kind of grass did you plant? A warm season grass, I'm presuming.
Yes, I believe it's Kentucky.
Oh, no, you put it down at the wrong time of year.
Well, I did the yard 3 months ago.
Oh, okay,
so
okay. That's good timing.
It became established, and now it's 100 degrees there. And
yeah, well, you can't do anything about that. I might have tried to talk you into a warm season grass, but it's too late for that now. So your grass is always going to struggle in the summer, but it will recover, and it'll be at its strongest in the fall, winter, and spring. So,
the grass is actually doing well. It's just the bindweed that's in spots, and it grows out, and we pluck it, and two nights later we'll go out, and it's got a 6-inch root already coming out in the grass again.
Yeah, I'm not going to suggest we fight this creature head on. Okay. What I would do where you are, because it's already hot in the summertime, I would buy a simple flame weeder, a little propane-powered device. And when you see
I have one.
Okay, good. When you see the vine coming up above the grass, just torch that single plant at the height of the day. The only thing you should go out and do, wear a big hat and torch that plant as it comes up. And just, you know, walk around and do this like once every 2 weeks. And then give your grass a good feeding in the fall. And you don't have to worry about drop seed with bindweed. We're not going to let any flowers open. Let no flowers open anymore. Make sure you torch the flowers. And I would say by the time we get to this time next year, because your grass will have gone through a wonderful fall, winter, and spring, I think that the bluegrass, which was a great choice for this weed, will have spread out its root system densely enough that the bindweed could well lose the fight.
Okay.
All right, man?
Sounds like a wonderful plan. I really enjoy your intelligence. Thank you so kindly.
Well, thank you for listening, Vince. I greatly appreciate it. You take care now, man.
Great day.
1-888-346-9499. Faye, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am good, Faye. How are you today?
Splendid.
Excellent. Excellent. And where is Faye Splendid?
In Narberth, Pennsylvania.
Right outside of Philadelphia.
Correct.
All right. What can we do for Faye?
I am trying to get a fall garden started.
Very good.
And I, on June 16th, I put broccoli, cauliflower, and some other coal crop, which now escapes me, into little pots. I started from seed, and it all came up, and I have it in my basement under lights, and then it's been like the land that time has forgotten down there.
You mean does that make you time?
Yeah, no, I keep going and checking, but these plants are getting nowhere.
Oh, well, you have to do things other than check. Now, do you typically start your own seeds for your summer crops?
I do.
And so you start tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers?
Yeah, tomatoes and peppers I will start indoors.
Okay. And what kind of a mix do you use to start your seeds in?
What they sell as seed starting mix.
Excellent, excellent. And what kind of a container do you begin with?
Peat, which I don't care for much, but it seems to be only what is the only thing available these days.
What? No. Why would you not use the same six-packs that garden centers and nurseries, the little thin plastic containers used. Those are the ideal size, material, and drainage.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't. I just buy them in the, you know, in the cellophane and.
Oh man, peat is almost impossible to work with. I don't like it either. No, I used to do peat pots because I was terrified of my ham-handedness. I barely have opposable thumbs. So I wanted to avoid the part where you take the baby plants out of their pots and kill them, getting them into the soil. I wanted to kill them later on in the actual garden. So I used peat pots. And what I found was because peat wicks its moisture into the air, that it was impossible to keep these containers whose sides and all their material was made out of this porous peat. It was impossible to keep them evenly watered. So I think the fault is not with you. It is that this type of container is very difficult to work with.
Yeah.
And the watering is the issue with the peat. I mean, it is nice that you can plant the container and all. But in truth, when I did that my first couple of years, at the end of the season, when I pulled out the tomato plants and stuff, I would often find that the roots had not gone as far as they should have.
It seemed to be all that they had available were the little peat pots.
Right. The way that you get this, because you buy starts. Come on. I mean, nobody starts all their own seeds.
Come on, Mike.
Yeah, I don't.
No, I don't either. No
one does.
Okay.
So what do you do with the plastic six packs that your little baby plants came in that you bought?
I generally recycle them, put them in the yellow barrel.
God, no. They probably just get landfilled somewhere. You're throwing out. And then you're going and buying peat pots, Faye. What's wrong with this picture? Oi!
Mike, you're not supposed to be this accusatory.
Oh, yes, I am. You have to pay more attention. But that's what you want to do, is
okay.
You want to start saving of those things and reusing them. You know, the six packs that you buy small plants in at the garden center, or the larger individual plastic, thin plastic pots that you get larger plants, like the tomato plants that are further along.
Now, what do I do about these very unhappy little seedlings?
That's a good question. What I would do at this point, I'm going to tell you to do two things. One, I'm going to tell you to take them outside and plant them. I know it's technically too hot for these plants, but the truth is, that's for when the plants have achieved a big size. That's when you want the cool weather to come in. So you could go outside now. You can take these peat pots outside. And what I would do is, do you have any kind of partially shaded area in the garden, a spot that doesn't get as much sun as others?
Yeah, it gets bright sun some times of the day and then shaded other times.
That's where I want you to install these plants.
Okay.
You can plant them peat pots and all, but get those pots into the soil and make sure the lip of the pot does not extend above the soil line.
Okay.
Because you want the entire pot, including the lip, to be buried. Otherwise, it is going to wick moisture into the air. That's the danger with these things. But that's okay. This is how we learn.
Right.
So take those outside. And I want you to water the heck out of them for the first week if we don't get good drenching rains. After that, then you can back off a little bit. By the time that the plants get to the point where they could bolt, where they could be negatively affected by the heat, the heat will be gone, or it'll be greatly lessened. And by the way, I also want you to hedge your bets, and I want you to get some seeds. Do you have any leftover seeds of these plants?
I might.
Direct seed some directly in the garden. That's
right now?
Yeah, sure, because the soil is warm. The baby plants don't mind the heat. They'll grow fast, and they should be just about the right size when we get to the cooler weather where both plants like to head up.
Mm-hmm, great.
Okay, Faye?
Thank you so much, Mike.
See, it worked out much better than you thought.
I hope so.
Thanks
for the advice.
Good luck.
All right, so long now.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week which we're calling Turning Your Compost, the dirty little secret of organic gardening. Jonathan in Northridge, California writes, I'm starting two compost piles and I'm wondering how often I should turn them. I decided to clean up our side yard. It hadn't been touched in about 8 years. So I collected a lot of leaves that I figured should make perfect compost for my veggie garden. I shredded them all up and put some in a compost tumbler I inherited from my grandfather, and the rest in a simple plastic fence-style composter. You know, the kind some extension offices give away or sell for cheap. I thought it would be best to just leave the piles alone and only turn them once or twice a month. But my father says I should be turning them every 3 days. How often should I turn my compost? And should I turn that tumbler more often than the pile? Love your show. Well, thanks, John. We really love having listeners all the way on the other side of the nation. And up top. And down south. And in the middle. And, all right. The answer to your question is what I like to call the dirty little secret of composting. If you mix up the correct ingredients, that's mostly well-shredded dry brown materials like your absolutely ideal super perfect fall leaves, and a much smaller amount of nitrogen-rich green matter, and moisten those ingredients as you go, I see no need to turn a pile that's in contact with the ground more than once, maybe twice, total. What I typically do is make a number of such piles in the fall. Some in composters made out of recycled black plastic, some in wooden bins, and many in wire cages, including my out-of-season tomato cages. And then I let those piles cook for a while. How long is a while? Well, it depends on the weather, my compost needs, and that darn real-life stuff that keeps getting in the way. Plus, I no longer seek out hard labor, the way I used to back when I was young, foolish, virile, and foolish. Now, if my compost needs are high and my supply low, I'll mix up a fast, hot batch. I'll combine a double-size amount of well-shredded leaves and a hot nitrogen source, like a couple of 5-gallon buckets of spent coffee grounds, in a big 5-foot-tall wire bin that's about 4 feet across with a chimney in the center. That chimney being a tube of the same kind of wire fencing, but only about 10 inches in diameter. I'll even water that pile if we don't get rain. And I'll watch that baby cook. You can see the heat waves rising up from the chimney for about a week or two. Then I'll lift off the outside cage, remove the chimney, and pitchfork the contents over into the same cage, refilling it. Typically, the bottom half of this new pile will be finished compost a week or so after that. At that point, I'll remove the cage for the final time, mix the unfinished material from the top into another bin or three, load the finished material from the bottom into a wheelbarrow, and use it. Now, this is great compost. Hot compost. Compost that's made quickly. With just shredded fall leaves and a hot source of nitrogen like coffee grounds or horse or poultry manure, has the most nutrients and great disease suppression powers. But let's get real. I do the work of collecting and shredding enough leaves to fill about 40 good-sized piles or bins, and so I feel I've earned the right to slack off on making most of it hot. I still make the long-term piles correctly by shredding and mixing the ingredients well, but I include cold kitchen waste as the green component, and then I just let those piles sit until the spring. By then, the bottoms are all finished compost despite my laziness in the winter cold. I use the best of that material right away, then mix all the unshredded stuff into one or two huge new piles. That material is primed, the weather's warming up, so these big piles are generally ready to use a couple of weeks later, which is, honestly, about as soon as I want to be pushing that wonderful wheelbarrow again. Now, there's nothing wrong with turning an above-ground, i.e. non-tumbler pile, once a week or so. It's good exercise, and it does make better quality compost. And if you have one of those recycled black plastic composting units, you don't even have to work as hard. Just use a shovel to extract some of the material from that convenient coal chute they all have at the bottom and shovel it back onto the top. Water it afterwards if the cover excludes rain. Some do, some allow it in, and or you're in a dry climate. Now, tumblers, spinners, and other non-ground contact composters are a different story. Because of their design and the fact that they don't allow access to earthworms, they should get a spin or a turn of the crank just about every day. The payback is that, again, if the mix of materials inside is correct, they typically provide hot, high-quality, finished compost in the shortest possible time. Don't forget to water these things regularly, though, as the contents dry out much faster than piles that touch the good oif. But no matter what else you do, get ready for the season of making your own super soil. Those precious leaves only fall once a year, and that time is coming soon. Well, that sure was some real-world advice about the turning of the compost now, wasn't it? Luckily, yous can review the question of the week in print at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! Our producer is threatening to turn me in a tumbler if I don't get out of this studio. You know, that could be fun. What? Oh, we're out of time! But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore with your location at garden@whyy.org. If you're going to send it without your location, send it to somebody else. Visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the answer to every garden problem in our alphabetized archive of answers. Listen to this show and old shows over your computer and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Fred Snyder. Rich Banowitz is our webmaster. That must make Sarah Schuhart our web mistress. Not that that's a bad thing. Our well-turned intern is Caleb Bissinger. Larry Roebling produced this edition of You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our show was edited by the woman who normally produces our show, the completely composted Alexis Landis. Unpiled and then forgotten Mike McGrath. But I'll see you again next week. What's going on when discolored circles appear in a lawn? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the most common causes of rings, spots, and patches, plus your fabulous phone calls.
A lush, lyrical garden of lavender, lima beans, ladybugs. Mike will help you launch it. Join us Saturday mornings at 11 for You Bet Your Garden here on WHYY.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports